Hi, everybody. This is a review, simply going through each of your lecture outlines one by one and hitting the high spots for each particular segment. We'll start with health and medicine. You should have your study guides or lecture outlines in front of you. Be ready to fill in your gaps in the notes or flag places where you can go back and listen to this or the full lectures online one more time. Talk about health and medicine. There are several issues of vocabulary. First, health. The World Health Organization defines it as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not just the absence of disease. Culture-bound syndrome is a disease or illness that cannot be understood apart from the culture within which it occurs. The example used in class was eating disorders being more prominent in the U.S. among middle to upper middle class Anglo women. Holistic medicine is a style of health practice or health maintenance that accounts for spirit, mind, and body. Holistic practitioners take seriously the World Health Organization's definition of health. Morbidity and mortality rates refer to illness and to death. Morbidity is the incidence of disease, the number of cases per thousand, let's say, for HIV, cancer, heart disease, and so on. Mortality rates refer to incidence of death. What are the statistics for life ending because of cancer, heart disease, accidents, gunshots? These are collectively quality of life indicators. What's it like to live in one country or one community versus another? Well, what are the morbidity, incidence of illness, and mortality, incidence of death rates? Social epidemiology is the study of the distribution of disease. Epidemiologists are a subdiscipline of sociology, and they study how disease and death are distributed. With regard to gender, women live longer but suffer more long-term illnesses than do men. This relates to health-seeking behavior, more prominent for women. It relates to dangerous occupations and socialization to violence, more prominent for men. Social class is by far the most robust predictor of health and wellness, especially in a country where health insurance or health care is a purchasable commodity. Those with the most money get the best health care. Race and ethnicity are carriers of social class. We tend to have disproportionate numbers of those below poverty among non-Anglos. Environment is also a carrier of social class. Environmental hazards, such as the water supply in Flint, Michigan, tend not to occur in wealthy parts of the country. From a functionalist point of view, sickness is dysfunctional, and there is so deeply embedded in our society rules and expectations for sick people that this becomes a cultural or macro or functionalist point of view. When you're sick, you get an exemption. You get the day off, you get sick pay, you're excused from school. In exchange for that, you first of all can't cause your own disease, you can't malinger, you have to go to the doctor and take your medicine. So in exchange for the exemption, you hold up your end by living up to societal expectations for those who are sick. We also expect a lot from our healers. We expect that they be trained, competent, to some extent kind, and certainly credentialed, that they go through a long training process and that they will have some form of answer, treatment, or a solution, or at least some remedy or modality that will help us get through and restore our health and functionality. From a conflict perspective, health care is a purchasable commodity to which there is unequal access. And the infant mortality rate, I think, is the most robust indicator of the health of a country. How good are we at keeping infants alive for 1 year? We also have the insurance industry as the vector for health care payment, and the insurance industry is primarily concerned with reporting a profit to their stockholders. So when you have those two dynamics working together, you have the burden of healthcare scarcity disproportionate to the poor. Healthcare is also a matter of social control. Behavior is in many ways controlled by the healthcare system. We have medication for anxiety. We have medication for ADHD. We have medication even for addiction. And when badness, if you will, becomes sickness, we have a healthcare industry that, in part, serves to control bad behavior, as it were, by creating a category of illness and then treating the illness. On a micro level, illness is a label, and even though it's better than badness, it's still not completely neutral. HIV/AIDS is a good example of an illness that carries a great deal of social baggage. So it's a stigmatizing and, in some sense, delegitimizing piece of an identity. So that's sort of the cliff notes on health and wellness, health and medicine. We move next to a presentation on politics, power, and authority. There's a partial lecture on this posted from today, where the politics and economics lecture go together, but there are also full lectures from last spring posted on the website as well. Power is the ability to set a goal and achieve it. Authority is the ability to get other people to do what they would rather not. And we regard the political process as generated through our government as authoritative. There are three types of authority. Traditional authority is authority based on custom. And the examples on this include authority conferred through basically your family. And we have existing monarchies, for example, I'll get to in a minute, that you inherit the position of head of state. You inherit the position of king, queen, or crown prince. The notion that parents have authority in our culture is also somewhat traditional. So parental authority, even in families and homes, is also an example of authority conveyed by custom. Rational legal authority is authority conferred by law, and the authority rests with the office. We have a president, but the president is only an authority figure because he or she, maybe at some point, occupies the office of the presidency. So rational legal authority is authority conferred by law and rests with the office. Charismatic authority is authority conferred by the leader's emotional appeal. The root word of charismatic is charism, which in Greek means spirit. So a spirited personality can draw people around him or her. And charismatic authority is unstable because it has to be embedded into the culture at some point. The ideas of the charismatic leader have to become embedded into an institutional form. And there are four types of institutional governmental forms. The first is a monarchy, which is a form of government headed by a single member of a royal family. There are monarchies that are largely symbolic, and the UK is an example of that. Queen Elizabeth is a figurehead monarch. Not so, for example, in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi royal family, the House of Saud, if you will, is the functioning government of that country. So we have symbolic monarchies and substantive monarchies, and Saudi Arabia would be an example of the latter. An oligarchy is a form of government headed by a small group. This is usually a transitional form of government where a dictator is overthrown, let's say, by the military, and a military tribunal or junta or coalition of military leaders will run the government for a while until either a new dictator shows up or they reconfigure and become, say, a democracy. So an oligarchy is rule by a few rather than rule by one. A dictatorship is rule by one through terror, through control. And democracy is a representative rule of the people. The root word for democracy in Greek means people's rule. Representative democracy, free press, free speech, and so on. So those are the types of government. Government functions in a variety of ways. From a functionalist point of view, we look to government to provide enforcement of norms, law enforcement. And the governmental authority figures that do this for us are local law enforcement and police, FBI, federal, local, and state law enforcement, and also military. Government also functions as a source of planning and direction, and by this we mean the creation and maintenance of infrastructure, roads, bridges. We also, as towns get larger, we account for where certain things should or should not be in a community, where residential homes should be, or where businesses are allowed to be, or churches, or liquor stores, and so on. So the larger the community, the more important something like zoning boards and city council is for the purpose of planning and direction, maintaining and adjudicating in some way infrastructure. Thirdly, governments function to arbitrate conflicting interests. If you've got a problem with your neighbor, you have, well, perhaps the zoning board to go to, or the courts if it's to that level. And so the court system and city government and municipal government and so on serve functionally to be the mediator when there's a conflict between an individual and another individual, an individual and a corporation, corporate conflicts, and so on. Fourthly, government functions as a source of social protection, and this loops back to law enforcement. Law enforcement not only controls or tries to enforce rules, they also, in some way, protect people from being harmed by people who break rules, in a sense. So protection and law enforcement essentially go together. So planning and direction, the maintenance of infrastructure, arbitrating conflicting interests refer to the court system. Protection and law enforcement go together to function in a stable, efficient, orderly society as the mechanism of governmental interaction. From a conflict point of view, all of those great functions work better for rich people, to put it bluntly. So planning and direction and infrastructure tend to benefit those that are wealthy. Conflicting interests are arbitrated more effectively if you can afford a lawyer, and there are safer and less safe parts of town that tend to parallel levels of wealth and power in those parts of town. Under this segment of a conflict response to functions of government involves C. Wright Mill's book called The Power Elite. He's also the guy that wrote The Sociological Imagination. And in that book, he argues that there's sort of a shadow, unholy triangle that actually runs most cultures. And he refers to this as the power elite. The points on the triangle are the political realm, the military realm, and the business realm, and these three work together. Examples of this would be in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, wealthy business entities or business people or simply wealthy people can contribute virtually unlimited amounts of money to government, and to put it bluntly, if you pay people in office, they are more likely to respond to your interests than just the common everyday voter, at least from a conflict point of view. So we have, from a conflict point of view, all those functions of government function better for the rich, and the power elite being kind of a shadow government, if you will, comprised of wealthy business persons who, in a sense, buy loyalty and services from government and maybe even through the military. With regard to politics in the U.S., there are two issues at stake here. One is political socialization. That's the matter of forming an identity. We become socialized to identify ourselves with one or the other political party, typically. These tend to be rooted in family, and we're socialized with a political identity in the same way we are socialized with any other identity. Participation in politics tends to depend on how much or how little any individual thinks that the political process or any political candidate will benefit them. Individuals tend to vote their interests, and if there's a high level of interest at stake, in other words, if people feel that that someone running for office can take care of a problem they've got or make their life better, they're more apt to vote. Finally, the matter of politics and religion. The example used in class was to point out that the Protestant establishment basically being described as three religious denominations, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, and United Church of Christ or Congregational, that members of the President's Cabinet throughout American history, members of the Supreme Court throughout American history, and the presidency itself is vastly disproportionately represented by members of those religions. And there's a reading on that by Davidson, Morrissey, and Krauss, and you should look at that. There is also the idea that when any change is introduced into the system, when we have the first African-American Supreme Court justice or the first woman on the court or potentially even the first female president, there needs to be an appeasement factor that goes that's involved. Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, for example, was also an Episcopalian in addition to being male. So he wasn't that much different from white male Protestant. He was black male Protestant. and so on. There is also a handout that shows a chart of the president's religion and several handouts in the reading that show how disproportionate the representation in the cabinet, the Supreme Court, and in the presidency is by members of the Protestant establishment. We move finally to the economy. A set of four vocabulary words. An economic system is the social institution through which goods and services are produced, distributed, and consumed. There is a production process for everything we buy, there's a distribution mechanism for everything we buy, and we consume either by using or by finishing anything that we purchase. Food, clothing, furnishings for our home, any and all things that we buy. And the economic system is the mechanism for that. Monopoly is the control of a market by a single business firm. These are generally illegal, although public utilities are an exception, as is Amtrak, which is heavily subsidized by the government. Social surplus is a term that means the production of enough goods and service, enough goods to meet one's own needs and have some extra to sell. It's really the tipping point between a horticultural and agrarian society, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Laissez-faire is a French term that means let them do. It's a form of capitalism that argues for minimal government interference, that the market will set both the rules and the price. Now, we have agreed that government needs to be involved with things like the Food and Drug Administration and other things, but it is regarded as anti-laissez-faire when that happens. There are three types of pre-industrial societies. First is hunting and gathering, very little stratification. These types of societies or cultures or tribes tend to be nomadic. They move around. You can only hunt out and gather up resources for so long, and then they move on. Horticultural societies take things that are gathered and plant them. Take things that are hunted and help reproduce the species so they can stay put. Horticultural societies are planters. Hunting and gathering societies are gatherers. So we move beyond horticultural to agrarian. Agrarian societies are the farming communities, and this is where the social surplus comes in. Horticultural societies get really good at planting what they need, such that they can grow more than they need and then can sell their farm goods to other people that no longer have to farm. They can, for example, become blacksmiths and learn how to shoe horses, and horses pull plows, and the farming industry gets even more complex and capable. And this is what moves us to industrial societies. Before too long, we figured out that pulling a plow with a horse is less efficient than pulling a plow with this brand new thing we invented called the internal combustion engine with machines and wheels, and we power it with oil. Industrial societies come in three types. There are primary industries, and these are industries that extract raw materials from the ground. Oil, mining, farming are examples of primary industries where we produce oil, we mine coal, and we grow cotton. Secondary industries Secondary industries turn raw materials into finished products. Oil is refined into gasoline. Coal is burned, and the energy from that drives steam turbines. Cotton is turned into blue jeans, as it were. Secondary industries, as I say, turn raw materials into finished products. Tertiary industries sell services, and retailing is an example of that. So a primary industry would be the farming of cotton. The secondary industry associated with that would be the clothing industry, in which garments are made. And the retail industry distributes it. That's a tertiary industry, as is also the educational system, which sells services. Conflict critique of post-industrial societies. We have pre-industrial, industrial, and post-industrial societies. And industrial societies are those types of cultures which we have now, where machines are no longer the most valuable resource, but information is the most valuable resource, referring to a book by Daniel Bell called the post-industrial society. From a conflict point of view, advancing to post-industrial society really changes nothing. Instead of factories and machines being the most valuable resource, information and software are the most valuable resource. So from a conflict point of view, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It doesn't matter what the most valuable resource is, it will be unequally distributed. And a brief word in post-industrial societies about postmodernism. Postmodernism refers to the diffusion or disappearance or dilution of boundaries, both national boundaries, but also boundaries in our own thinking. What do we imagine? From whom are we cut off by boundaries? That's less and less true in the advent of the internet, email, texting, Skype, and FaceTime. More structurally, the definition of art and music has changed over time. There, 200 years ago, high art was something you knew exactly what it was. Abstract art, well, our boundary over art and quality art has been diffused in some way. Two aspects of the U.S. economy today. One dealing with the movement forward by women into professions to the extent that they now characterize with nearly equal representation previously male-only professions like ministry, law, and medicine, although there are still some differences with some of those subspecialties. So the first of these is the advancement of women into professions to a degree unheard of 100 years ago, much less 50. Secondly, the underground economy. That is, there's an economy through which money flows for illegal goods and services, and that involves the illegal drug industry, somewhat shifting with the legalization of marijuana and the increase of the opioid epidemic, as it were. Marijuana farmers who no longer can sell an illegal product to the same degree are now selling opium, and we've created an unheard of before heroin crisis. There's also an aspect of the underground economy that involves illegal labor as well. Finally, theoretical perspectives regarding work and employment. From a functionalist point of view, the economy depends on the educational system and, in some sense, the family to instill a work ethic, and the educational system to provide the kinds of workers the society needs. From a conflict point of view, as societies become more complex, the idea that Marx came up with called alienation becomes even more intense. Marx argued that what ultimately becomes a macro-level concern starts with the reality that an individual who only works on part of an assembly line and who only contributes a small portion of a finished product is alienated from the product or production process. That's become even more intense as we now not only have machines, but we also have computers and servers and software. The work that most individuals do is more disconnected from the finished product. If you work in a cubicle processing paper or processing reports or on an assembly line doing only part of the assembly process, you are alienated from the fruits of your labor, if you will. And Marx argued this is more prominent among those with less, more prominent among the poor. Finally, from an interactionist point of view, there are two kinds of work. There are occupations wherein individuals are largely replaceable and learn to do the job through on-the-job training. There are professions that require a great deal more time for training and credentialing and certifying, and they tend to be more stable, and to replace a professional requires usually a longer search and maybe even more extensive training. On a micro level, workplace satisfaction occurs when you have some autonomy, when you like the people you work with, or you have some control over what happens in your life. Even an occupation can be deeply satisfying if you like the people you work with and you have some autonomy in the process. Finally, unemployment is a hit on one's identity. The job you have is, in many respects, an extension of your name, and when you are unemployed, whether that is through being fired or by being unable to get a job, your sense of self and your identity is diminished. Well, I wish all of you good luck, and I'll see you on November 28th. Happy Thanksgiving.